You're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284AL, Haleiwa. It's time now for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will consider the attractive force of paramagnetism on plant growth, get the upper hand on pests and diseases of Malvaceae, and learn how to protect the integrity of organic seed. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapaa Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment, 823-0556.
808 Equipment Rentals, providing Bobcat rentals island-wide with or without operator, including septic digging, vegetation removal, trenching, terracing, demolition, and more. Over 30 years of operating experience on Kauai. 808 Equipment Rentals in Molawa'a, 823-1000.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building, fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
And welcome to all our listeners out there on this beautiful island chain of Hawaii and far afield if you're listening in on the internet. It's Paul and Robin. We're so grateful to be back here, back in our seats at the garden show, In the Garden on the Farm here on KKCR.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thanks for listening.
How's your garden, Robin?
It's beautiful. It's definitely starting to take a nice turn. There was some hard work involved in fluffing my soil after some heavy winter rains we just had, and you just got to get down on it sometimes, and I did, and things are sprouting and growing beautifully.
Fantastic. You know, people are saying to me so often, what's up with the weather? And people think, I don't know, that it seems like it's raining more, that the winter has not disappeared yet, and I know we have these variations, but it seems that the winter is still with us. And for those of us who live in or garden or farm in high rainfall areas, it can be tough to find that window where you can turn the soil and work it. So prayers for good weather coming, for planting, for working with the soil, stimulating those energies. And we will turn our attention to the skies above. And in our celestial session, consider those influences of the moon and the celestial sphere. And we'll start as we do with the Hawaiian moon phase of the day, or the night, as the case may be. And this Hawaiian moon phase brought to us by the Hanalei Watershed Hui's calendar of 2014. It's the tide calendar, beautiful calendar available at various locations on Kauai. And today's Hawaiian moon is Ku Kahi. This is in the first Anahulu, or week, first of 3 weeks in the Hawaiian moon calendar period of Ho'onui. And Ku Kahi rose this morning on Kauai at 7:21 a.m. this morning and will reach her transit or highest point in the sky at 2:03 p.m. and she'll set at 8:47 this evening. Only 3% of the moon's beautiful face is illuminated, and the new moon was this past Monday at 8:15 p.m. And the Mana'o on Kukahi is it's the second of three ku moons that ended the ku kapu at the beginning of the month. So for those first four moons traditionally was not recommended for planting, but that was because of the kapu period, or the kapu on, or rather to say, determining people's behavior. So it was definitely not so much tied to the natural influences, but more about control of people. And yet this was considered not only from that system, but also from being aware of the influences that were positive for growth. This day was recommended for planting plants that want to grow upright, and that would be maya, banana, kalo, taro, and uala. And kalo planted on this day would have one shoot, and that is the Hawaiian moon reading for today.
Excellent. Well, in the biodynamic look at things, today through Friday, the moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a good time to work with our root plants. At that time, we will enter into the transplanting time again. So Saturday and Sunday this weekend, the moon will be in Gemini, which is an air sign, making it a good time to plant some flowers. So that's kind of a fun weekend project. Zinnias, marigolds, sunflowers, amaranths, all of our beautiful summer flowers that thrive in long days. That's what we want to be looking at now, bringing a little beauty to our gardens and also pollinators. And Monday, Tuesday next, the moon will be in Cancer, a water sign, making it a good time for our spring leaf plants, planting things like lettuce, Asian greens of all kinds, Chinese cabbages, Swiss chard, does well in my garden year-round, collards, all these things are great things for planting during those leaf times, as it's the leaf of the plant that we eat.
Beautiful. Well, it seems like there's plenty to do in the garden with the plants, and hey, folks, get out there and do it. bring your portable radio, please. Bring us out to the garden with you. We're here in an air-conditioned studio, and we sure would love to join you on a walk through the garden, through your farm, and bring us along with you. So we have some very exciting news to share with you and some hopeful news. There's so much stuff going on in the world that seems like, where do we get traction? Where do we get to play a positive role? But we are having some good things happening on the local front. And first of all, we'd like to thank our listeners for the positive feedback we got about show last week, which was a rebroadcast of a lecture by Dr. Don Huber, who was here on Kauai last year to give some lectures about the risks of glyphosate. And that his lectures can be found on YouTube, but you can also go to hear that particular lecture. You can go to the kkcr.org website and click the audio archive link at the top of the page, and you will find the April 23rd show of In the Garden on the Farm has that lecture. As well, you can check out the show from the day before, April 22nd, on Felicia's show, Kauai Soapbox Live, and we did do a live broadcast from Kauai Community College during her show, focusing in on soil remediation, panel speakers, and had a pretty good time doing that. If you couldn't join us or hear that show, you can also hear that on the archive show. Also want to thank everybody who came out to make the 13th Biennial Kauai Community Seed and Plant Exchange a success. The weather was beautiful. There was a lot going on that weekend, but people came down, and we had a really great time at Earth Day Rising as well. Great thanks to Felicia and the Akamai Learning group there that made us so welcome, as well, of course, WIPA Foundation, who hosted the event too. Everybody who came out and shared, we were very blessed to be recognized by the Hawaii State Legislature and got a certificate of recognition given to us by Derek Kawakami for the good work of Regenerations and the seed exchanges and all of us who are working to take care of plant diversity and share it widely so that it is common and it doesn't disappear. So great, great fun time.
And well-deserved recognition, I might add.
And I want to recognize Robin for growing so many of the beautiful plants that we gave out at the Seed Exchange. She does it very much behind the scenes, but it's greatly appreciated, and they were beautiful.
Well, thank you. I hope those moringas all find wonderful homes.
I'm sure they will. And yes, so the next, so we're going to continue to talk about seed in our notable news section. And Robin has a new publication that she's excited to share with all of us.
I am, and I actually learned about it in this month's Acres magazine. It's the April, well, now just at the end of the month, in their organic news department. And it's a free publication that's being offered by the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association. And the publication is called Protecting Organic Seed Integrity. And it's available at the OSGATA website. So that's an acronym for the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association, spelled OSGATA.org. And on their website, you can download for free this publication called Maintaining Genetic Purity in Seeds. And it was really interesting for me to read, especially because what I wasn't aware of is that even in organic food, there is a tolerance, a low, slight tolerance for organic contamination. So products that we buy on the shelf labeled organic, at this point, there can be less than 1% GE, as in genetic engineering, contamination of the food, and it is accepted. However, in seed growing and for any kind of seed producer, there's a zero tolerance for any genetic contamination at all. And that's not all that novel, because even a conventional seed grower has zero tolerance, for instance, for pests or diseases in the seed. So zero tolerance is kind of commonplace in seed production. But I'm really happy that they're taking that very firm stance. And what the publication goes on to talk about is that this takes a lot of work to grow pure organic seed that is free of GE contamination. And it's expensive and it's laborious and there's a lot of record keeping involved. And so this is something that falls on the shoulders of the farmer, of the seed farmer himself. And so the point of the publication is to inform people and help to support them to be able to do it, not necessarily financially, but there's lots of great information in there. And what was most important to me was reading about the papaya. They actually have a section just on GE papaya, which is one of the plants that's very common here in Hawaii and kind of affects us the most. The other plants described were alfalfa and corn, of course, which that's a whole nother story. But most of the GE contamination of papayas actually happens by people buying an unlabeled GMO papaya in the grocery store, maybe a visitor, and they're cruising around and they decide to have a little picnic, and by the roadside they clean out the seeds and they just kind of toss them into the bushes. Well, they don't know that there's maybe an organic papaya farm nearby, and the organic papaya farmer doesn't know that someone just threw some contaminated, GE seeds over there. And with papaya, they don't have a real probability of cross-pollinating that much. It's a pretty low rate. But still, when we're talking about organic seed production for papayas, what was interesting for me, and I hope that I can explain this well in words, is that we can have our tree tested and the flesh of the fruit of that tree that's been tested to be non-GMO. They use a test called the Gus test. And you can do that, but each seed inside the fruit, so the fruit itself, the flesh itself may be a non-genetically engineered, but each seed represents a single pollination event. So each and every seed within the fruit runs the risk of carrying some contamination with it. And the traditional Gus tests are usually using young leaves of growing plants, although there is a Gus test that can be done on the seed itself. But the test is a destructive test in that you can't plant the seed after it's been tested. They have to peel it apart. And so this is a really important issue for us here in Hawaii. There's a big demand out there in the marketplace for organic papayas, organic GE-free Hawaiian papayas at that. And so it's going to be interesting to see how we can manage to do that here.
Truly. I was on the UH Seed Lab website yesterday, and I noticed that they were quite proudly proclaiming that their GE, that their papaya seeds have tested GMO-free. So even the institution that actually created the problem by creating the GMO papayas are heaving a sigh of relief at this point that at least in this tenuous moment, they're able to kind of keep their hands on the reins of this, you know, otherwise completely unpredictable and uncontrollable situation. So it does take a lot of diligence in this way, and certainly it's great to have organizations like OSCADA leading us in the right direction, and I would advocate for some sort of cost-sharing program. It may well be that an organic seed and trade alliance like that would be looking at cost-sharing programs for people to get the testing, but it seems like in so many things, the onus or the responsibility should be on the institution that created or the corporation that created the need to do the testing rather than the people who are suffering from it.
Sure. Well, that's an interesting discussion. And this is a long paper, so there's a lot to talk about. And I don't think we'll squeeze it all into the few minutes that we're going to cover this with. But what they basically say is farmers should possess their practical right to choose the way they want to farm. And so it's going to be a group effort. It's not going to be placed the onus completely on the GE, creator of the GE seed, or the other person downstream trying to grow an organic. There's going to have to be a mutual agreement. And so if you're living in an area where someone wants to be growing the rainbow papaya or the sun up or whatever it is, there's going to have to be an agreement made between the farmers themselves. And I actually like that. I think getting the regulation back to the people who are actually doing it and doing it near each other. But there's lots of things dealing with lawsuits and who's going to pay and how that's all going to work out in the paper. But really, for the people out there who are sowing a lot of seeds, farmers, commercial growers, really what it comes down to is if you're buying seed, you want to be assured that the seed is GMO-free, that there's zero contamination. And that's all about testing, testing, testing. So right from the get-go, you want to call up the seed company and ask them if they've had their seed tested. And particularly here with crops that are commonly engineered, corn, soybeans, wheat, things like that. However, the paper lines out that there are so many undocumented test sites going on for all kinds of crops that no one even knew they were playing around with GE, and they're undisclosed. So here we get back to the disclosure issue again, is just tell us. Just tell us if you're growing a GE crop nearby. And that's the part that's kind of unregulated, the disclosure, once again. So asking your seed grower, and if enough consumer demand comes to that seed catalog, that seed company, and says, I want pure seeds, then that's what the company will produce because they want their customers to be happy like any business does.
Well, very interesting. And again, if people are interested in reading that publication, it's available at OSCATA, OSGATA.org. Protecting Organic Seed Integrity is the new publication available for free. They do want to know a little information from you about where you are and what you do. They're trying to get a scope on who's interested in this kind of information. But as we know, organic seed is only growing in interest across all sectors. And as people are interested and they have that investment in receiving organic seed, we'll be doing what we can do to protect that seed. And on that note, we have nice development I'd love to announce right now, which is that the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative is beginning its multi-location leafy lettuce variety trial here on Kauai.
Yes.
Yes, we've been talking about this for, about a half a year maybe, but we're finally getting about to it. So Regeneration's Botanical Garden, University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, and the Kohala Center on the Big Island operate the Hawaii Public Seed Initiative. And we have different projects happening on the different islands. We've done workshops, trainings, and this year we're kicking off the first of our variety trials. Kauai is leading the way, which is exciting. And thanks to Dr. Hector Valenzuela, crop extension specialist at the University of Hawaii, who's developed the trial for us. He's put together this observational variety trial for Kauai lettuce growers. It will involve growing 6 lettuce varieties, and all the seed was grown on either Kauai, Oahu, and Molokai. So we're already starting with some seed that has either been adapted for decades in the case of the University of Hawaii's varieties, or varieties that have just been grown at once. We do have, I think, 8 growers right now, and we still have room for a couple more. So if you're interested in participating in the lettuce variety trial, the basic target that we're shooting for is that you'll be able to grow about 45 to 90 plants. So might be better for somebody who has a larger garden or somebody who's doing commercial production. That's about the size where you can really see what's going on with the varieties. If you could just grow a couple individuals, it might not show as much, but we are looking at getting different locations around the island. So give me a call if you want. The number for Regeneration is 652-4118 to get involved.
So I have a question about that for some of the more backyardia types who might have a big garden. You said it's an observational trial. Does that mean that you're not planning on taking these plants to seed and producing seed for them so you actually get to eat your lettuce?
Thank you, Robin. I should have actually described what it's about. So basically, it's about trying different growers, trying the same varieties at their location and seeing what does well this time of year. And it's an observational variety trial and not a scientific replicated trial, because it takes a lot less room and it takes a lot less effort. With a replicated trial, you have to do 6 plots that are all the same in different parts of your farm, and then that has to be replicated at multiple sites. So this is more about just, rather than taking the quantitative data, taking the qualitative and just getting that general sense of like, wow, this tasted great and did really well.
Right. So flavor plays in.
Flavor totally plays
Excellent.
In. Color. I mean, it's all about the reasons that we grow lettuce. It's not about measuring how many grams of ash was produced when you burned it or something like that. It's about, hey, is it good? Did it fly off of the farmer's market table, or did it never even make it out of the nursery because it didn't do well or whatever? So it'll be really fun and interesting to see. These are different varieties that people are either familiar with or we have tried before. And part of the seed lot has come from the original source seed is from Frank Morton at Wild Garden Seed. But those 3 varieties were grown out by Glenn Tevis on Molokai. Mm. And we have a variety that was grown out by Ken Lindsay at his farm in Moloa'a. Happy to say he's farming with us up in Kalihiwai now. And a couple of varieties from the UH Seed Lab, a Manoa and a Nui Nui, that are quite popular and have been around for decades.
I love a Nui Nui. It's like a little iceberg. They're like little iceberg lettuces. I grew them out this like early spring, or if we're there yet, late winter, whatever that was a few months ago. And it's just a delightful lettuce. The Hawaiian Rainbow. Really love that one.
Yeah. So thanks again for everybody's participating. And if you're interested in getting involved, we've got a couple spots left. 652-4118 is the number. And you're listening to In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. Coming up in this hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Scott Nelson from the University of Hawaii about pests and diseases of hibiscus family, members and how we can overcome them without using any terrible pesticides or herbicides or the kind of things that we never would spray on our garden. And we're also going to be talking about paramagnetism, quite an interesting, arcane subject. Is
Indeed.
It time to get into that now?
Well, not quite. I wanted to take a quick stop at the kitchen garden before
yes, of course.
We got there.
I am kind of peckish.
And I wanted to talk about thyme today. Thyme is just one of my favorite herbs in the garden. I find myself going out there and snipping on it all the time. I know lots of people feel that way about it as well. I talk to them all the time about it. Thymus vulgaris. And I've tried lots of different varieties here. There are many, many varieties floating around out there. I've not had any trouble sprouting the seeds from them, although I've never had a plant go to seed.
My experience as well.
Yeah, mostly purchased seed. I did see a first flower on my current plant. The plants seem to last for a good couple of years in my garden, and then they'll get a little woody, kind of peter out, and then they definitely have that sort of mysterious dying back thing that they do, and you can't figure out, well, you were just happy last week, you know, what happened. But I found that the thyme of Provence is my favorite one. It does really, really well. People talk a lot and ask a lot about lemon thyme. It's a plant I've grown many times and lost many, many times. It doesn't seem to be very hardy here. There's a variegated version of that and then also an all-green version of that lemon thyme, and it just doesn't seem to persist. So I wanted to just give the hot tip that if you really want lemon thyme, what I do is I use my regular thyme, and then I shave off some lemon zest, and I mix them together, and I get a little bit of a lemon thyme kind of flavor. So if your lemon thyme doesn't seem to want to stick around, no need to worry. There's always a Meyer lemon to be found somewhere in the neighborhood, I'm sure. It contains thymol, which is it's one of its main bioflavonoids. It's antiseptic. It's antifungal. Also has in it our new favorite antioxidant, zeaxanthin. Seems to keep popping up in all the herbs and plants that we talk about lately. Lutein. And thyme has the highest antioxidant levels among all herbs.
Wow.
So it's really potent. Uses in cuisine, it's so varied. Everything from beans, every cuisine I know can find a place for thyme in one of the dishes. As we know, it's great with potatoes. It goes great in a chili, beans, all kinds of things. I don't want to make us all too hungry now.
As they say, everything but your breakfast cereal.
Yes, precisely. And one of the things I read about it recently that I thought was interesting that I'd like to share is that if you make a strong tea of thyme, when you have a sore throat, gargling with the thyme tea can be really potent to reduce the inflammation and help ease the discomfort of a sore throat.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Love this little thyme plant. It's so ornamental. And it, like you said, it gets woody and it almost feels like, wow, this is going to be a little bonsai. But sadly, they do. They fade away just when they seem to be getting to their most charismatic. And then you got to start over. So
it's true. It's very mysterious to me how that happens. And it's one of those many mysteries in the garden that always keep me going back for more.
Mm-hmm. Well, great thanks to the thyme plant. And thank you for sharing a little bit out of your kitchen garden, Robin. And now we're going to turn to Secrets of the Soil Builders and discuss a little understood, even maybe after our research, topic of paramagnetism. Paramagnetism, shall I jump in?
Please.
Okay, please. Paramagnetism turns out to be the tendency of a material to be attracted by an externally applied magnetic field, and it includes most chemical elements. So some materials have a magnetic property in and of themselves, and those ones have their electrons are all lined up together, which is why it holds that magnetic charge. Whereas paramagnetic material, the net orbital spin are sort of pointing in every direction. It's chaotic, and it only aligns when there is a magnetic force. And so that's why they're paramagnetic and not why they're not purely magnetic. They have no magnetic pull without the applied field, and paramagnetic material exhibits a weak magnetic energy field in response to the Earth's electromagnetic field, according to Steve Diver, researcher at the National Sustainable Agriculture Information Service. He pulled a lot of his knowledge and information from Dr. Phil Callahan, who is recognized as one of the leading researchers who brought paramagnetism into the forefront of alternative agriculture thought. And a lot of that is really kind of arcane stuff. I know Robin and I both tuned in on to some of Dr. Callahan's research, and it was extremely esoteric.
Sure, which is, I'll remind you, what we like to give you a little bit of esoteria on this last week of the month when there's a fifth Wednesday. We figure that's a kind of a dynamic day, and I think it's a great day to be talking about this. And that is definitely recommended reading, a book called Paramagnetism, Rediscovering Nature's Secret Force of Growth, yeah, by Dr. Philip Callahan. It's out there on all kinds of different websites, and you can read excerpts from it on the internet.
Truly. And thank you to Acres for such an amazing collection of books that we could dive into for the next number of years. What I got out of this was that rock dusts have a paramagnetic force, and that basalt, there's two basic kinds of parent rock on the planet, granite and basalt. And basalt is actually a preferred source of minerals for remineralizing soil, or for introducing soil into existing soils. The problem is that our soils here are highly weathered. Our basalt also varies in terms of its elements and what sort of qualities it has. And our basalt here is low in calcium, and it's also relatively low in silica compared to other basalts. And it's unknown to me whether or not, and we've checked in with some friends, we checked in with our buddy Joseph Dunsmore, who's interested in this and has actually met Dr. Callahan, but we're uncertain whether or not the Kauai parent rock, which is the basalt rock, has strong or weak paramagnetic qualities. But what I did get was that the other main players in the soil, organic matter, humus, microbes, and plants, exhibit what's called diamagnetism. That is, they are repelled by a magnetic field, as opposed to paramagnetic stuff, which is attracted to it. And so if what you do, if you're working with paramagnetism, you're trying to strike a balance between the repelling forces of the organic matter in your plants and the attractive forces that are inherent within the rock dust. And some of the ability for that rock dust to be effective is based on its particle size. And a lot of the rock dust that we get, like if you go out and you get the glacial rock dust, it is ground to an extremely fine powder. And the rock dust that we can get easily on Kauai is a much coarser ground. And because of that, it takes a lot longer, because there's a lot less surface area. It takes a lot longer for those elements and even for that magnetic force to play a role and to influence the biota, the living stuff of the soil. And so in order to harness the greatest effect from paramagnetism, we'd need to grind our rock dust down to a finer product. I'm not exactly sure what sort of machine would do that kind of thing.
I'm thinking my Mr. Coffee grinder is going to have a hard time with that.
Yeah, we're going to have to go industrial size on this kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so.
So more to learn. We do one thing that we could learn as a community is to, there actually was a sensor. So back to Dr. Phil Callahan, the leading pioneer researcher on paramagnetism, developed a device, and it was one of many inventions he came up with. I'm not sure if his other inventions were actually ever created or just theoretical, But apparently the PCSM, or Phil Callahan Soil Meter, which tests paramagnetism, has been created, and there is at least one supplier on the web who has it for sale. I did find it with Pike AgriLab Supplies, and the nice lady I spoke with there didn't know whether or not anybody in Hawaii is using it. However, Robin seems to have some information.
Sure. Well, our dear friend and advisor son called in, and he wanted to let us know that he's pretty sure Ned Whitlock, that's of Moloa'a Organica, does have one of these devices.
Nice.
And that he has great experience with testing. And so, you know, if you want to head to the farmer's market and check in with those guys, and you're really, if we light your fuse here, you light your flame a little bit and you get kind of excited about it, you could check in with those guys and see about getting the Blue Rock or even your soil tested in that manner. So I believe there is one here on Kauai. Yeah.
How exciting, Ned, one of our great friend farmers and inspiring practitioners of agriculture, who is also participating in our lettuce variety trial. So I'm going to be swinging by his farm in the next couple of days, and maybe he'll show off his soil meter to us and give us some more information. This stuff always sort of comes to light, and we're grateful that our community reaches out and gives us the rest of the story. So we can share it with you either now or in an upcoming show. But also to say that the UH Chemistry Department has a super fancy schmancy looking electron paramagnetic resonance imaging system that they just purchased.
Far out.
So they can do all kinds of really amazing lab work with that, and perhaps I gave a call to those folks as well and didn't get through to anybody, but it seems like University of Hawaii has the capability to do some very exacting tests on that sort of thing. Not sure if they're hooked up with the agriculture department or if they're just doing pure chemistry experiments. So anyway, that'll be something to look into as well.
Well, interestingly, in some of the research I did, mostly didn't understand in depth a whole lot of it, but I did come up with some recommended reading or things that you can look at that might inspire you. And there's a fellow named Bill Nicholson, and he's got a PDF, basically on the internet that I read. It's called Rock Dust, Paramagnetism and Towers of Power, and how they affect plant growth. Now, I remember, and also to add to that, a really wonderful book, a follow-up to The Secret Life of Plants, is Secrets of the Soil, written by the same authors, and that's where I first learned about this, and Towers of Power. And so basically, made of rock, or in this tiny experiment in Bill Nicholson's paper, he simply used sandpaper, actually, wrapped around a twig, a branch of some kind, and he buried it in the soil with starts and kind of replicated this experiment. And certainly the plants, the radishes that grew with this little tower in the pot, grew way better than all the other ones. And so the Tower of Power is very interesting. I don't completely understand it, but when you look at the results, you think, wow, like, and that was so simple to do. So this is all just very interesting for our minds to get into the possibility of improving our crops in such a simple way. And probably the grinding of the pea gravel sized basalt rock that we can get on Kauai might be the hardest part of it all.
Certainly no. We have the rock. We can get our hands on it. Let's try it. There's lots of reasons to remineralize the soil. Thanks to Sun, who's always reminding us about that and demonstrating it. And we're going to be hearing about a workshop coming up at Wansong Farm a little bit later in the program. Just to conclude this section, to give a bit of a summary, Steve Diver, again, concluded that paramagnetism supercharges the energetic plant system, thus enabling roots and leaves to function and metabolize at a higher rate of activity. which results in enhanced photosynthetic carbohydrate production, thereby resulting in improved plant growth and yield, improved nutritional composition, and a natural ability to resist insect attack. He spoke to some research that showed the positive effect of paramagnetic rock dust on plant survival and vigor by taking some of that paramagnetic dust, putting it in a film canister, and similar to your Tower of Power, just placing it in a pot and then comparing it with plants that didn't have this self-contained bit of paramagnetic dust and saw dramatic differences.
Yeah, when there was no mixing.
Exactly.
It was inside plastic. It's really pretty phenomenal.
So try it. It couldn't hurt.
Yes, definitely not going to hurt.
And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa. And this is In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio. And we're just figuring it out right here for you all. And our next guest is about to join us. Hold on just a moment. Sing now on Hibiscus Family, and we're joined by our friend Dr. Scott Nelson. Scott is Associate Plant Pathologist at the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture based in Hilo on Hawaii Island. He specializes in epidemiology and extension education and has authored countless publications through the College of Tropical Ag and with agroforestry.net, Craig Elovich's fine organization there on Hawaii Island. Scott, it's great to have you back with us again.
Thanks, Paul. And by the way, I'm in Honolulu now.
That's right. You told me that last time. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
How is it there?
Oh, the weather's great, and the university is fine. I enjoy it here, so everything's good.
Excellent. You're teaching a class or two this semester?
This semester I'm teaching one class. It's plant disease management.
Mm, right up our alley.
Indeed. So we're finishing off our focus this month on hibiscus, and I know that you've given some attention to solving some of the problems of cultivating one of the most popular plant groups here in the Hawaiian Islands.
Yes, well, the Malvaceae, you know, include a number of different species, not just hibiscus, but, you know, some endemic plants and also some landscape plants and even some agriculturally, you know, produced plants, such as okra and cacao. You know, ilima is one of those endemic plants, you know, used in landscapes. Of course, we have some of the native abutilon, you know, abutilon menziesii is another plant. Then there's abutilon striatum, which is more of a common abutilon that has a virus called abutilon mosaic. Then, of course, there are hibiscus, you know, the flowering hibiscus that are common in landscapes.
And that abutilon mosaic, that does affect the native species as well?
No, not to my knowledge. I haven't seen it affect those species.
Thank goodness.
But, I'd have to check my database on that one, but I've only seen it on certain abutilon species, most notably the one called abutilon striatum, okay, which is you know, a common one grown. But and even the ones that are infected with the virus are sometimes sold as, you know, unique varieties where the grower doesn't really realize that it has a virus.
Mm.
And so viruses, some of the most difficult problematic diseases that we have, both ones that afflict humans and plants, is that a disease that you can manage, or if you have an infected plant, must you be rid of it?
Well, I mean, you can't eradicate a virus from a plant once the plant is infected. But in the case of this particular disease, I mean, it doesn't really debilitate the plant, and it's kind of attractive in a way, so there's no really need to manage it unless you don't want the symptoms in your landscape.
D- Does it give a variegated appearance to the leaves, or what's going on there?
Yes, it gives a mosaic. And it's kind of a beautiful mosaic, you know, and that's why I think some people are selling it as, you know, they're giving a name like Tropic Fire or some name like that at the farmers markets. You can sometimes see them for sale.
Wow. Interesting.
But, yeah, you have to destroy the plant because we don't have any pesticides or any fertilizers that can remove the virus from the plant.
Well, we know. Thank you for expanding our vision on Malvaceae as a general, which we have focused in on. But there is indeed within Malvaceae, hibiscus seems to be the most popular one, and it seems that folks who even have the most basic landscape in Hawaii probably have at least a hibiscus or two. Oftentimes, people have hibiscus hedges, and it seems like all manners of problems crop up for folks who aren't paying close attention to their plants, and so it seems like problems on hibiscus is pretty common.
Yes, they are, Paul. One of the most common problems is the gall mite. It's the hibiscus erineum mite that causes galling and distortion of the leaves. You've probably seen that before.
Certainly. I've seen it and pruned it off many, many, many plants.
Yes. Well, that's one of the management practices, is pruning off the diseased foliage and, of course, discarding it if you can. And then some people combine that with using a miticide, sprays on the foliage of a pesticide that's designed and labeled for mites on hibiscus.
I've been reading lately that there's a miticide being made out of cinnamon. Are you familiar with that? Because that seems like a little bit more of a organic style choice. Are you familiar with that one?
Cinnamon?
Yes.
That, of course, is an old, pesticide, but I think it's probably on the less effective range. But, sulfur would probably be better, and also, some sulfur products are approved for organic use, but sulfur is a good miticide. Mm-hmm. And so if you were having this problem, usually like the red hibiscus is the one that really shows these symptoms most prolifically. The combination of cutting back and foliar sprays with sulfur, repeatedly would be the way to manage this problem.
And is this and other problems with ornamental hibiscus in part because the plants may be stressed and so that they're attracting unhealthy conditions?
In some cases, I think that's true. For hibiscus in general, I think the problems that you see depend on the environment. Like with the gall mites, for example, you see much more of it on red hibiscus in a drier environment. Whereas in a more high rainfall environment, you might see like a disease called bacterial leaf spot. And that's a bacterial disease that's kind of not that common in Hawaii, but in the high rainfall areas, you'll definitely see it, and it's definitely a problem for the plants, bacterial leaf spot.
Is that specific to hibiscus, or does it afflict other plants as well?
It's basically specific to hibiscus, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So treatment management practices there?
Well, again, cutting back the diseased foliage. And in this case, we don't have really effective bactericides for spraying, but a copper-containing product such as, if it's labeled for hibiscus, you can use like a Champ or Coside. These are both fungicides and bactericides, these products.
Okay.
So you really can't stop the rain, but so you really have to cut back and spray, just as with the mites.
Right. We're speaking with Dr. Scott Nelson. He's plant pathologist at the University of Hawaii's College of Tropical Agriculture, and we're talking about solving disease and some pest problems on Malvaceae, the hibiscus family. And as far as that bacterial leaf spot goes, it seems like if you live in a high rainfall area and you're planting your plants in an area that has poor air circulation or doesn't get full sun, you're sort of inviting these kind of conditions. So know that no matter where you are, you still probably have somewhat of a selection of places to put plants so that they can be at their healthiest.
That's correct, Paul. The disease is really a function of leaf wetness, and so the longer your leaves remain wet, the more prone they are to the bacterial leaf spot. So, you know, aeration and sun exposure can help reduce the severity of that disease. But there's a, you know, another disease that's common on hibiscus are the root knot nematodes. In some cases, where the nematodes infect the roots, I mean, the plants can eventually defoliate and even die because of, you know, secondary rots of the roots. But, you know, some of these hibiscus varieties are quite susceptible to root knot nematodes, which, you know, they live in the soil, they infect the roots, and they cause galling and swelling on the roots.
And so do commercial growers use particular root stocks that are resistant to those?
No, they don't. I mean, people usually choose hibiscus for the flowers, and so they're the ones that are susceptible pretty much. I mean, you'll see them in landscapes, and so you'll first start seeing kind of a yellowing of the leaves or maybe some defoliation. Eventually, when you look at the roots, you'll see that they're galled, and so what people, they don't replant the same one, or they may replant a different type of plant there. But, you know, there are certain popular hibiscus that people want to grow, and but, you know, when in the presence of the nematodes, it, especially with a lot of irrigation, that can cause problems.
Definitely. We see nematodes really come up when there's overwatering situations happening.
Yeah. The water helps not only to spread the nematodes, you know, because they're essentially aquatic animals, but it also, you know, induces more rot, because sometimes the roots will crack open where you have these galls, and with a lot of water you can get, you know, opportunistic fungi that start to rot the roots a little bit. And the nematodes, you know, they need water, and the plants need water, so it's the water's good for both, but it also promotes the nematodes, yeah.
You know, I also wanted to ask you about whitefly, because this is something I discovered on some large hibiscus plantings near where I live. And they'd gotten kind of in the bottoms of the plants, the lowest leaves, and they had these huge, like, puffs of cotton, it looked like, growing out of the undersides of the leaves. And I was wondering if you might be able to describe what exactly that is, if that really is whitefly, and what kind of treatments we might use for that.
Okay. Yep. Well, there's, you know, several species of whiteflies. That one, that white stuff is called flocculant.
Flocculant.
Flocculant, yeah. F-L-O-C-C-U-L-E-N-T. Flocculant. And it looks like an old man's beard hanging off.
Exactly.
Yeah. Other species of whiteflies, they also create some flocculant, but it's not as dramatic looking as that. And so often what I've found with whiteflies is, I mean, the earlier you can manage them, the better, because you won't see the buildup of the population and all of this flocculant. So you really have to spray. Now, there are some insecticides, maybe a granular form, like, say, something like Merit, that you could use for foliar sprays. If you want more something more organic or less toxic, you could use something like Safer Soap.
That sounds like our spade.
Yeah, Safer Soap. But you have to get good coverage and also contact the insects directly so you have to spray from underneath.
Mm.
Yeah, and you may have to control ants because the ants are farming the sap-feeding insects, such as whiteflies, because they the ants eat honeydew that's coming out of the insects' bodies. This honeydew is a sweet substance, like a waste material.
Mm-hmm.
It's more commonly seen with aphids and scales, but even, you know, whiteflies are also sap-feeding insects, and if there are ants tending them, they're also protecting them, so you might have to control the ants around the hibiscus by using some type of bait, probably,
mm-hmm.
designed for that species.
So I took the approach of trying to prune off most of the highly affected branches, and then
yeah.
and then you want to treat the rest.
That's a good idea. You know, some combination of sanitation, which is pruning, and pesticide application is the way we have to treat successfully most of these hibiscus problems, and whiteflies is one of them.
Well, it sounds like through good horticultural practice, folks don't need to be too worried about the pests that they may encounter, and maybe with the exception of the nematode, which is always a persistent problem, but we know good crop rotation methods can reduce, eliminate that problem, at least in the short term, perhaps in some perennial plantings of hibiscus or other members of Malvaceae. Harder to avoid a long-term buildup of nematode, but certainly seems like through good horticultural practice, we can have good success with this family of plants.
Yes, and when if you're going to plant a new hibiscus plant that's maybe in a pot, you got it from a nursery or something, you should look at the roots, you know, first, and if they're galled, of course, maybe you shouldn't plant it. Try to avoid using that plant, because if this has galls, this probably has the nematodes.
Mm.
And if you scout your plants, if you look at your plants on a regular basis and you notice a problem developing, you know, try to manage it early rather than letting it build up and to an advanced stage.
Right.
Well, always good advice.
Dr. Nelson, great to speak with you again. Before we say goodbye, I want to make sure that folks know that you have a newly renovated website, HawaiiPlantDisease.net, which is a great resource in terms of all the information that you've assembled here, a lot of your own research, and great information about these pathogen problems that are a mystery until we have good folks like you who shine a light on them and tell us what we're looking at and how to treat it.
Well, thanks for those comments, Paul, and it was my pleasure to speak with you today, and people can always contact me if they want more information about anything we discussed today.
Well, thanks again, and have a great semester. Hopefully you'll come over and give us a lecture sometime here on our beautiful garden island.
Thank you. I hope to do that.
All right.
Goodbye, Paul.
Aloha.
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 And we've got time for just a few quick announcements for you. We've got a Goat Keeping Basics workshop coming up this Saturday, May 3rd, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. And it's brought to us by our friends at Kauai Kunana Dairy and the University of Hawaii Cooperative Extension Service, Kauai County Livestock and Range Program. Boy, that's a mouthful. Yes, and it's going to be held at the Kauai Agricultural Research Center in Wailua. Information for meat and dairy production will be covered, animal nutrition, grazing management, etc. There's a very nominal fee. You can call 274-3472 to register. We also have the Kauai Community Radio Spring Membership Drive coming up May 5th to May 15th. You can become an early bird or become a wave rider, different ways you can contribute to keeping this show and so many great shows here at KKCR on the air. Go to kkcr.org for more information right there on the homepage. And also want to let you know about the Kauai Next Step Concert Rally happening Saturday, May 10th from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the War Memorial Hall in Lihue. It's a free event. A musician, Makana, will be headlining and also acting as the MC. Other musicians include Sashimon, Liko Martin, the Sacred Earth Choir, plenty of speakers, Dustin Barker, Walter Riddy, Gary Hooser, and many more. And that's coming up Saturday, May 10th, and this is all in an effort to get that, it's all in an effort to get the charter amendment passed, and I know that they're still looking for signatures for that charter amendment to protect us against pesticides and GMO contamination. This is KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K284, AL, Hale, Eva. And this has been In the Garden on the Farm with your host, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Dr. Scott Nelson. And again, you can reach him through his website, hawaiiplantdisease.net. And we want to invite you to tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life. And stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with Tracy from 1 to 3 p.m. And then Shaka Kayaka comes to us with the Papule Show from 3 to 5. So keep it tuned in to Kauai Community Radio. And thanks for listening, Ohana. Aloha.
It's important to make sure your family has a plan in case of an emergency.